Have you ever wondered why some people seem utterly incapable of empathy, constantly make everything about themselves, and leave emotional devastation in their wake? In The Narcissist You Know, psychotherapist Joseph Burgo takes us beyond the overused label of narcissism to explore its most dangerous manifestation, extreme narcissism. This isn't just about selfie culture or garden variety self-absorption. It's about a defensive personality structure that affects approximately 5% of the population and can cause immense suffering for those in their orbit. Oprah Winfrey called this book a must-read, while Psychology Today praised it as illuminating and compassionate. Drawing from decades of clinical experience, Burgo reveals how narcissistic behavior stems not from excessive self-love, but from profound shame, and how understanding this can help us navigate relationships with the narcissists in our lives without becoming casualties of their psychological warfare. Self-righteous narcissists like Fiona weaponize moral convictions to establish superiority over others. After discovering animal cruelty online at age 11, Fiona becomes a passionate vegetarian and later vegan, not primarily from compassion for animals, but as a vehicle for demonstrating her moral superiority. She stages protests, creates intense friendships based on ideological purity, and ruthlessly cuts off family members who mock her beliefs. Her relationships follow a predictable pattern. Either people completely support her views, or she banishes them. These narcissists appear in many contexts, particularly organized religion, where they ostentatiously display devotion while passing harsh judgment on others. Mark, a supposedly spiritually enlightened husband, uses scripture to criticize his wife Winona while dismissing her needs. When she complains about his neglect, he turns the tables. "You're always talking about your needs, what about mine?" Such relationships often begin with mutual idealization that deteriorates into polarized winner-loser dynamics. The narcissistic bigot represents an especially toxic variant, viewing himself as enlightened while seeing victims as inferior and contemptible. With righteous zeal, these individuals believe they alone possess truth and have the right to abuse those beneath them. Their self-righteousness serves as a defense against disavowed aspects of themselves projected onto the inferior other. Studies confirm that homophobes often secretly harbor same-sex attractions they've rejected. George Reckers exemplifies this dynamic, a Southern Baptist minister who devoted his career to converting gay men while secretly hiring male escorts. Donald Trump exemplifies the winner-take-all mentality instilled by his father Fred, who taught his sons there were only two types of people, winners and losers. While his eldest son Freddie couldn't meet these ruthless expectations and died of alcoholism at 42, Donald embraced the killer mentality. From youth, he was hyper-competitive with no close friends, developing a defensive wall around himself. His management style featured volcanic eruptions of rage, public humiliation of employees, and contemptuous dismissal of anyone who disagreed with him as idiots and fucking morons. When dealing with self-righteous narcissists, understand they're immune to reason and truth. Don't attempt to change them. They won't listen. In workplace settings, responding to blame with simple apologies, "I'm sorry, how can I fix this?" proves more effective than protesting injustice, which only intensifies their attacks. Addiction and narcissism share many features. Though not all addicts are narcissists, many display pronounced lack of empathy, having stronger relationships with their substances than with their partners, whom they view as mere deliverers of supplies. They withdraw from interpersonal stress into drug-induced grandiosity and narcissistic relational styles. Consider Ian, a 27-year-old computer scientist who became addicted to a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. Despite intentions to found his own company after a startup acquisition brought modest wealth, he couldn't settle on a business plan, and instead spent increasing hours in his virtual world, where his avatar rose to celebrity status. He lived with his girlfriend Concha and her two children, paying their rent but developing no real relationship with them. In therapy, Ian revealed shame-based difficulties stemming from anxious, hypercritical parents who made him feel perpetually wrong. Though academically gifted, he felt fundamentally defective, partly due to a surgically corrected cleft lip that made him self-conscious. What defines the addicted narcissist is their use of substances to escape their shame-ridden, damaged selves. Some become addicted to plastic surgery, like Toby Sheldon, who spent over $100,000 to resemble Justin Bieber, or Rodrigo Alves, who underwent 20 procedures to look like the perfect Ken doll. Despite nearly dying during a procedure, Alves remains committed to surgical self-transformation, having been hooked since his first nose job at 20. Michael Jackson's narcissism and addictions stemmed from brutal childhood abuse. His father, Joseph, beat him mercilessly from age 3, conducting sadistic discipline sessions even after the family achieved fame. Ashamed of his appearance, particularly his big nose that resembled his hated father's, Michael underwent countless surgeries starting at age 19. He bleached his skin and transformed his face, yet remained miserable except when performing. "I'm addicted to the stage," he confessed. "I'm unlimited when I'm on stage. I'm number one. But when I'm off the stage, I'm not really happy." If you're involved with an addicted narcissist, recognize you can't save them alone. Those who try may be engaged in codependency, appearing selfless while actually enabling the addict's behavior to satisfy their own needs for feeling competent and needed. 12-step programs help addicts confront shame within a supportive environment, though persuading the addicted narcissist to seek help is challenging. Like the self-righteous narcissist, the vindictive narcissist must always be right, but with a crucial difference. They actively seek retribution against perceived slights. Challenge their authority and you become not just wrong, but an enemy to be systematically destroyed. Their need for revenge becomes an organizing principle, sometimes consuming decades of their lives. This pattern appears frequently in marriages where one partner is highly narcissistic. Adam's wife Lily would explode over seemingly minor issues, him working late without calling, outpacing her on a bike ride, or even supporting her decision to take college courses. If Adam defended himself, Lily escalated from specific complaints to absolute condemnations. "You understand nothing about love," or "You're so unbelievably selfish." She would then orchestrate elaborate schemes to punish him, from destroying his personal belongings to spreading malicious rumors among their friends. Tyler's experience with his new boss, Phil, illustrates workplace vindictiveness in its most destructive form. When Tyler failed to recognize Phil on their first encounter, asking, "And you are?" Phil took deep offense, responding with contempt, "You're boss, genius." From that moment, Phil systematically undermined Tyler, rejecting his proposals without review, contradicting himself about budget availability, and publicly humiliating him during team meetings. Phil's vendetta extended beyond professional boundaries, spreading false rumors about Tyler's competence and character. When Tyler attempted an end run by sending a proposal directly to the company president, Phil exploded with terrifying rage, screaming threats and profanity. The situation deteriorated into constant harassment until Tyler resigned, after which Phil vindictively sabotaged his job search with negative references and even contacted potential employers to discourage them from hiring him. Sarah Palin exemplifies the vindictive narcissist in politics. Nicknamed Barracuda in high school for her relentless pursuit of victory, she inherited this competitive drive from her father, who taught her that second place was equivalent to failure. As mayor of Wasilla, she demanded department heads resign if they'd supported her opponent, attempted to fire a librarian who opposed her book banning efforts, and terminated a respected police chief who disagreed with her policies. Her vindictiveness extended to personal vendettas. She routinely used her position to settle scores with former classmates and local critics. When challenged legally, she fabricated stories and lied at nearly every turn, creating alternative narratives that painted her as the victim while destroying her opponent's credibility. When dealing with a vindictive narcissist, prevention is crucial. Avoid becoming a target by never wounding their self-esteem or causing even minor humiliation. Document everything from the start, as they often initiate their campaigns long before their targets realize they're under attack. If you've already caused offense, take a legalistic approach. Preserve all communications, keep detailed logs of interactions, and rely on third-party witnesses. Build a support network of people who know your character and can vouch for your integrity. Be prepared for sophisticated smear campaigns and plausible lies that damage your reputation. But don't retaliate in kind. This only escalates their assault and provides them with ammunition. Instead, focus on maintaining professional boundaries and documenting their behavior pattern. Remember that vindictive narcissists often self-destruct eventually, as their need for revenge ultimately alienates allies and undermines their own interests. Bullying narcissists typically emerge from deeply chaotic, abusive households where identification with the aggressor becomes a crucial survival mechanism. Rather than processing their trauma as victims, they transform into perpetrators, aggressively projecting their painful feelings onto others. This psychological dynamic forms the foundational core of narcissism, a relentless effort to escape profound feelings of defectiveness by systematically making others feel inferior. The childhood wounds are so deep that dominating others becomes their primary strategy for emotional regulation. Lizzie's story vividly illustrates how narcissists methodically wound those around them. Her new coworker, Denise, initially presents herself as the quintessential friend, attentive, emotionally supportive, and remarkably attuned to Lizzie's personality and needs. Their friendship intensifies at an unusually rapid pace, characterized by constant text messages, shared lunch breaks, and weekend activities. However, concerning warning signs gradually emerge. Denise begins subtly isolating Lizzie from her existing social circle, making calculated remarks about their supposed shortcomings and displaying obvious emotional withdrawal whenever Lizzie maintains other relationships. When Lizzie begins dating Mark, Denise's behavior deteriorates dramatically, bombarding Lizzie with increasingly desperate texts during her date, then launching into a vicious character assassination when Lizzie doesn't respond immediately. This pattern reveals the classic narcissistic fear of abandonment masked as controlling behavior. Lance Armstrong's case exemplifies how narcissistic bullying can operate on a grand scale. His relentless pursuit of winning at all costs stemmed from a deep-seated need to escape core shame, leading to both athletic achievement and ethical compromise. When journalists began investigating his doping practices, threatening his carefully constructed heroic image, Armstrong unleashed a systematic campaign of vicious attacks. He dubbed Sunday Times journalist David Walsh a little troll, conducting a vendetta, and weaponized his considerable wealth, popularity, and media access to systematically bully accusers into silence. His tactical approach included filing strategic lawsuits, negotiating confidential settlements, and orchestrating public smear campaigns. He publicly attacked former team soigneur Emma O'Reilly with particularly cruel precision, falsely labeling her an alcoholic and prostitute. Similarly, he branded Betsy Arndrew, another truthful accuser, a crazy bitch, demonstrating the narcissist's tendency to attack perceived threats with disproportionate aggression. Bullying narcissists, perpetually fleeing from what they perceive as shameful loser status, rarely respond to logical reasoning or appeals for empathy. Their narcissistic defense against core shame is so deeply entrenched that they cannot genuinely empathize with victims without confronting their projected shame, something they almost never willingly do. In professional or social contexts, strategic escape often represents the best solution. However, with family bullying narcissists, where transferring is impossible, it's crucial to remember that shame and humiliation drive their destructive behavior. Rather than attempting to reason with them or challenge their perspectives directly, the safest approach typically involves careful management of their triggers while maintaining emotional distance. This might include avoiding shame-triggering situations, practicing strategic agreement when necessary, and developing strong personal boundaries without overtly challenging their authority. At a school awards banquet, Berko encountered Monica, the quintessential know-it-all narcissist. Despite heading a human resources department, she dominated conversation without asking questions or showing interest in others. She redirected every topic back to herself, demonstrating her supposed expertise in everything from real estate to advertising, even when actual experts sat at their table. Know-it-all narcissists aren't merely social bores. They exploit others by requiring an audience to witness their superior knowledge. Often academically precocious as children, they found relief from shame through intellectual achievement. As adults, they make difficult colleagues who monopolize conversations, reject input, and alienate others with their my way or the highway approach. Jesse, a freshman in college suffering from depression, exemplified the know-it-all narcissist using intellectual superiority to escape family dysfunction. Academically gifted but lacking discipline, he struggled with college demands while coming to terms with his sexuality. He spoke dismissively of ignorant people, obsessed over grammatical errors, and affected British sensibilities despite never visiting England. Behind this facade lay an alcoholic family, a distant father, depressed sarcastic mother, drug-dealing dropout brother, and sister with an eating disorder. Jesse's intellectual posturing served to separate himself from them. They're ignorant, fucked-up losers, and I am nothing like them. Steve Jobs epitomized the know-it-all narcissist at the highest level of achievement. His colleagues called his persuasive power a reality distortion field, a blend of charismatic rhetoric, indomitable will, and fact-bending that defied reality. Jobs routinely took credit for others' ideas, categorized people as either enlightened or assholes, and treated those he deemed inferior with withering contempt. Control dominated Jobs' personality. He either seduced through idealization or bullied into submission. From childhood, he rejected authority, driving without license plates, using handicap parking, and speeding recklessly. When trapped with know-it-all narcissists, we often become hostile or antagonistic, wanting to shoot them down when forced into an inferior role. Rather than engaging in this winner-loser dynamic, remember that shame motivates their behavior, even when invisible. Their relentless need to demonstrate superiority betrays underlying doubt about personal worth. Seductive narcissists possess charisma that makes them almost irresistible. They light up the room with magnetic personalities that draw others in. While not all charismatic people are extreme narcissists, many lack genuine empathy despite their ability to make others feel important. They exploit this skill for manipulation, bestowing attention that makes targets feel so good they want more contact. Bill Clinton exemplifies this trait, giving undivided attention and making people feel nobody else matters when he's with them. Unlike genuinely empathetic charismatic people, seductive narcissists only simulate empathy, understanding what makes others tick to manipulate them. They appeal to our narcissism in an implicit bargain. I'll make you feel fascinating and desirable if you do the same for me. Julia, a beautiful British receptionist in her mid-20s, came to therapy complaining of emptiness rather than pain. Though seemingly bored with life, she lived well beyond her means through men eager to escort her to expensive restaurants and events. Julia instinctively knew how to make men feel important through her undivided attention, and would tell each lover he was the first to give her sexual pleasure. When men inevitably fell in love and wanted commitment, she would gently cut them loose with practical excuses. Her narcissism likely stemmed from losing her mother at age 6, after which her father disappeared into grief for years. Madonna exemplifies the seductive narcissist whose behavior stems from early maternal loss. After her mother died when she was 5, Madonna developed a pattern of seducing and exploiting people who could advance her career. Former boyfriend Dan Gilroy noted she always had other guys lined up, each serving a purpose. She would seduce people by making them feel special, then discard them once they'd served their function. When confronted by her fiancé John Benitez about her simultaneous relationship with Steve Newman, Madonna cruelly claimed she made him and he was nothing before her. To cope with seductive narcissists requires exceptional self-knowledge and awareness of our own narcissistic tendencies. Few can resist being adored by someone who makes us feel fascinating and worthwhile. This is especially true for those whose parents failed to provide joyful adoration in childhood. The best defense is modesty. Distrust sudden infatuation. Question someone who idealizes you before truly knowing you. Narcissistic parents view their children not as independent beings, but as extensions of themselves, leading to two distinct patterns, idealization or scapegoating. These parents either elevate their children as living trophies that reflect their own grandiosity, or demean them as repositories for their deep-seated shame and inadequacy. This dynamic creates profound psychological consequences that often span generations. Earl Woods, Tiger Woods' father, presents a compelling example of generational narcissism and the idealization pattern. Earl singularly devoted himself to molding Tiger into a golf prodigy, famously declaring to Sports Illustrated that Tiger will do more than any other man in history to change the course of humanity, a statement revealing both grandiose expectations and the merging of father-son identities. Earl's older children observed his intense focus on Tiger, noting how their father functioned more as Tiger's best friend and coach than as a traditional parent. This unusual dynamic shaped Tiger's development profoundly. Raised as the epicenter of his father's emotional universe and conditioned for ruthless competition, Tiger never developed crucial emotional skills like humility or empathy, becoming what his half-brother described as a solo flyer whose whole world revolved around Tiger. The case of Celine illustrates how narcissistic parents often live vicariously through their children's achievements. From age 4, her mother thrust her into the competitive world of beauty pageants, subjecting her to exhausting rehearsals and relentless pressure to win. The psychological toll became evident when 7-year-old Celine developed clinical depression and an eating disorder, forcing medical intervention. Though the pageant ceased, her mother simply redirected her narcissistic needs into Celine's piano lessons and academic performance. This early conditioning led Celine to become a doctor, perpetually exhausted by caring for others, yet compulsively driven to provide relief, unconsciously repeating patterns from her childhood. Many survivors of narcissistic parenting, particularly those with narcissistic mothers, report devastating emotional abuse. These parents routinely tell their children they are stupid, worthless, or mentally unstable, projecting their own unconscious shame onto their offspring. A particularly destructive pattern emerges when narcissistic parents create family dynamics of winners and losers, often pitting siblings against each other. They frequently designate one child as the scapegoat who can do nothing right, while another becomes the golden child, representing perfection. This manipulation creates lasting family rifts and psychological trauma that can persist well into adulthood. For those raised by narcissistic parents, healing often requires either completely severing ties or establishing rigid boundaries, a challenging process complicated by deep-seated guilt and an ingrained need for parental approval. Extreme narcissists rarely seek psychological help or demonstrate meaningful change, leaving their adult children caught in an endless cycle of hoping for love while blaming themselves for its absence. This self-blame, combined with cultural pressure to maintain family relationships, makes establishing healthy boundaries particularly difficult for children of narcissistic parents. Understanding the winner versus loser dynamic is your most important tool for coping with extreme narcissists. While they may appear merely grandiose from a distance, once pulled into their emotional orbit, you'll inevitably become entangled in their psychological game of who's up and who's down. What makes extreme narcissists so challenging is their powerful effect on your self-esteem. The seductive narcissist makes you feel grand and lucky, while other types work to make you feel like a loser. Their supreme self-confidence and conviction they're right often makes you question yourself and doubt your perceptions, creating an Alice in Wonderland sense of unreality. When wounded by narcissistic contempt, we may unconsciously adopt similar defensive strategies, righteous indignation, wounded innocence, or blame reversal. Without awareness of the winner-loser dynamic, we become trapped in a battlefield of mutual attacks, meeting contempt with contempt. The solution lies in focusing on your own narcissistic vulnerabilities rather than assigning blame. During her divorce, Tima Swithin found it helpful to view her narcissistic ex-husband as a child throwing tantrums, a frightened boy full of shame. This perspective involves emotionally imagining the narcissistic's inner world and painful childhood experiences. When under attack, try superimposing the face of a lonely, unloved child over the adult before you. This compassion helps preserve your self-respect while avoiding further threats to their fragile self-esteem. With romantic involvements, the best approach is avoiding extreme narcissists entirely or disengaging once you recognize their nature. Don't enter relationships expecting to change them. They lack the capacity to respond to compassion with compassion. When disengagement isn't possible with family members, bosses, or coworkers, remember that shame drives their behavior. Avoid wounding their fragile self-esteem, as appeals to reason or fairness will fail. While narcissist has become a popular term of scorn, we rarely extend compassion to extreme narcissists as we do to other mental illnesses. This book places narcissism on a continuum and identifies what we share with extreme narcissists rather than emphasizing differences. Coping effectively often means confronting our own narcissistic vulnerabilities. When others wound our pride, we may respond with similar defenses to ward off shame. Understanding our own narcissistic responses is crucial to maintaining self-respect when dealing with narcissistic behavior in others.